Paul Bogosyan is Professor of Philosophy at New York University and Distinguished Research Professor of Philosophy at the University of Birmingham in the United Kingdom. He is also the Director of the New York Institute of Philosophy and the Director of New York University's Global Institute for Advanced Study. He was Chair of the Philosophy Department at New York University from 1994 to 2004, in which time he built it up to be one of the world's leading philosophy departments. In fact, the QS World University Rankings ranked New York University number one in the world in philosophy in 2014 and 2015. His research interests are primarily in epistemology, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of language. He is the author of Content and Justification, Philosophical Papers, published by Oxford University Press in 2008, as well as Fear of Knowledge, Against Relativism and Constructivism, published by Oxford University Press in 2006. Consciousness, obviously, is an old historical term. It, to a certain extent, dates back to the ancient Greeks. Also, in the medieval periods, it had more of an association with the term conscientia, which was to do more about moral beliefs and desires as opposed to any kind of conscious or mental state. Given more prolific attention under the realm of Descartes, especially with dualism and the potential aspect that the mind is distinct from the body and the brain. To a certain extent, in the 20th century, this has been more than questioned, to say the least, as it's come under the objective external study of science, particularly neuroscience. Of course, the debate isn't done there. Loads of thinkers in this area think that science alone can't explain consciousness and the mind, even though both of those are distinct entities, if one is looking at it from neuroscience, philosophy of mind, or psychology. But for the purposes of this statement, saying any kind of subjective conscious experience or any kind of conscious awakening itself is distinct from the brain. Others say it simply is the brain. You get problems of qualia and a hard problem, whether this is actually a problem. So you've got two spectrums. Some say that the mind and consciousness isn't reducible to the brain. Others say that it literally is the brain. You've got someone like John Harb, the area of mental causation, which is an approach slightly down the middle, which denotes it's more about how you're defining these terms and how these are how some problems arise. As an expert and a distinguished philosopher of mind, primarily before we start any kind of general overview or picking apart any of these issues, how would you first go about attempting to define consciousness itself?
You know, the word itself, consciousness or conscious of, being conscious and so on, these have been used in a wide variety of ways, often true for terms that are of central philosophical interest. You know, they have a life in the language, and in the language they are used in many different ways. So it's really more a matter of making sure that you zero in on the phenomena that interest you, on the phenomena that are philosophically interesting, and simply make sure that you then explain which of those phenomena you mean to be talking about, because the word itself won't guide you in a very definite way. So, you know, we sometimes contrast being conscious with being asleep. But on the other hand, if what you mean is, you know, that subjective feeling that is characteristic of certain kinds of conscious state, for instance, pain, tickles, and so forth, then even when you're asleep, if you're having a dream, that's a state of consciousness. So that's an example where you really need to specify exactly what it is that's of interest to you. And it's up to you to say what it is. I think language is often a distraction rather than an aid here. So the thing about consciousness, one thing about consciousness, the thing that figures in the hard problem, in the question of whether physicalism is a complete account, is that phenomenon that we're familiar with very, very intimately. When we experience something like a pain or a tickle or a visual sensation, which is that there is something that it's like for the subject to undergo that experience. And we mean to focus on that what it's likeness aspect, and to ask whether the mere motion of completely physical entities that are not themselves conscious in that sense could explain how conscious states like that could emerge.
Do you just straight off the bat here, Paul, I know you also specialise in philosophy of language. Is it apparent that, I don't know to what extent you're a fan of Wittgenstein or not, but are you immediately saying that the way we use language, in particular language games, immediately poses a problem in terms of how we use language and words to assume definitions and problems in the first place? Are you saying this is already a problem?
You know, Wittgenstein is somebody I've studied at great length, in some even quasi-obsessive way. Although I often find that I don't believe virtually anything he says. But I find that, you know, one of the things about him is, although he thought that a lot of these problems should be dissolved rather than solved, he was so keenly aware of just how problematic they were that he basically lost sleep trying to figure out how he could dissolve them. You know, he wasn't a facile thinker by any means. And I think that's why he can be a source of great insight, because he really understood the very depth of the issues that he wished would go away. But, you know, one of the things that Wittgenstein liked to do is to say is the exact opposite of what I was just now saying, which is that language, we really only understand the terms that we're using when they're used in their sort of ordinary non-philosophical contexts. And he thought that philosophers would wrench them out of those contexts and basically make a hash out of them. Language would go on holiday, as he said, and you would be talking pure nonsense as you tried to get the words ripped out of their ordinary context, do some philosophical work. I don't believe any of that. I actually think that we often have a very clear view of exactly which phenomena we mean to be focusing on. Our attention is directed like a laser on the phenomenon, and what we have is difficulty finding language that can unambiguously or clearly communicate what it is that we have zeroed in on. So it's really a kind of the opposite model of what Wittgenstein thought.
Okay. From that, I still don't know to what extent you may be stuck in the bottle. But moving on. Now, okay, so You've raised the first relevant point, which is obviously language is going to be fundamental in this. Now, as a philosopher of mind, what's the best definition or operation to use of consciousness, and which one gives the potential for more fruitful study? Because obviously you are a philosopher of mind, so you obviously deal with a concept of mind and consciousness. So talk about which one you feel for you professionally is the best one.
Well, as I say, the one phenomenon that very much interests me is this what it's like aspect to a mental life. This is something that is to be contrasted, as it were, both with complete lack of sentience in the way in which we might imagine a stone. There is nothing that it's like to be a stone. There is something that it's like to undergo visual experience or to experience a pain. And it's also to be contrasted with what might be termed purely representational states, if there are such things. Things like beliefs, though typically beliefs are also thought to have a conscious aspect. But it's much easier for us to understand how there could be states of a non-conscious thing that represent things, although I myself think that that itself is a very complicated notion. But the main thing is that what we want to do is zero in on this qualitative aspect, the one that you refer to with qualia, the phenomenal aspect of consciousness. So when you say, look, define that for me, you know, there should be a kind of paradox staring at you, because it's one of those very elementary aspects of mental life that you can point to, but it would be extremely hard for you to define, or certainly you would have trouble using words that would convey it to someone unless they already understood those words to express what it is that you're trying to get them to understand. So all you can do is point, to say, look, you know, pinch yourself. Okay, in the pinching yourself, there is an actual, a physical thing that happens. You know, a force is exerted, the skin is compressed. But then, in addition to all of that, there is a feeling, you know, a certain kind of pain, typically. And that pain is a qualitative aspect of your mental life. It's a way it feels like for you to be in that state. And that's what's referred to by consciousness, on at least this way of zeroing in on what it is that's of interest.
So it'd be fairly safe to assume that you're far more akin to the camp of Thomas Nagel, what it's like to be about, what it's like to be Paul, what it's like to be Tony.
Yeah, I prefer to focus on much, much smaller, as it were, aspects of experience. What it's like to be a bat might encompass a huge variety of different subjective states.
So that's what you consider important to study from your perspective. What do you have to say for example, there's quite a few neuroscientists that don't actually bother with the first person subjective experience or what it's like to feel some kind of physical or mental sensation, any type of qualia. They are just more concerned about studying brain states externally and what this can be correlated to. Are you saying that's fine and you can just separate the disciplines in two? They look at one thing, you look at the other? Or is there an overarching problem here that shows there is a problem to be addressed between the objective scientific study of consciousness on one hand and the philosophical problems it might create on the other hand?
To the extent to which there's absolutely no problem in studying aspects of the brain that don't have to do with consciousness. So it's not as though consciousness has to figure in absolutely everything. And moreover, not everything that a neuroscientist does is something that depends on saying that we understand the way in which conscious states emerge from purely physical states. Moreover, there's a further complexity, which is what my colleague Tom Nagel and even Dave Chalmers, I guess, think. And that is they think it maybe it's obvious that conscious states emerge from the brain. But they think, therefore, we have misconceived how the brain ought to be characterized. Because, if you look at Nagel's book, one of the things he argues is that a purely material conception of the brain won't do because, after all, it's quite clear that we are conscious and that consciousness emerges from the brain. And there would be no explanation for how we could get consciousness emerging out of the brain if all we had were the classical conceptions of matter. So there are many different options in play here as far as the relation between the physical and the mental are concerned. But one attitude that I don't really get is when people say, I don't know what you mean by this thing consciousness, you know, I just don't believe it exists. And obviously there are ordinary mental states, but why think that they have any kind of peculiar property that needs explaining? I think that that attitude I don't really understand, because I think that there are qualitative or phenomenal aspects to our mental lives, and that they are very, very distinctive in comparison, for instance, with merely physical properties, properties of length or mass or charge or any of these things, is blindingly obvious. And to the extent to which we turn away from them, we are simply ignoring a very important aspect of what is there.
Even if these qualitative and subjective experience, even if they're ineffable to a certain extent, they're still there, regardless of whether they're potentially ineffable.
Well, you know, ineffability is a very tricky notion. I had this experience of arguing about this recently. So, you know, people are very fond of saying things like, it's very hard to describe the subjective experience of sound, for instance, because words are very different from sounds, right? If I describe it to you in words, I give you some language. Well, that's very, very far from the thing which I'm trying to describe. There's a kind of fallacy in that line of reasoning, because if nobody thinks that it's difficult to describe a car, but the description of a car is very different from a car. So it's not as though, in general, you have difficulty using language to describe things. What I think is true is that unless you have zeroed in yourself on the phenomenon that people are trying to point you to, I mean, the reason there is any kind of difficulty here is that these are, after all, private, as it were, they're private items. What you can point to in the physical world are states of your hand or your eyes or whatever it is. But, the feelings themselves are subjective states that you yourself experience and you can zero in on, and then you have to make sure that the other person is zeroing in on exactly the same phenomenon that you mean to be describing. But having said that, there's no reason in principle, once we've calibrated our terminology to one another, why I can't use language to describe what I'm feeling and convey that to you. Now, that's what you do when you go to the doctor and you say, I've got a throbbing pain in my head.
You've already, to a certain extent, espoused why you think there is something phenomenologically real for what it's like to be something. So I know you've written previously on eliminativism to a certain extent. So at this stage, I'm assuming from what you've said, you're not really in the camp of someone like the Churchlands and perhaps to a certain extent Dan Dennett. For example, I won't ask you whether you think consciousness is an illusion because you've already answered to how it's not, but perhaps a softer approach to it in terms of at least the unified self might be an illusion. First of all, do you think consciousness is an illusion? If you don't, are you willing to possibly concede that unified consciousness could be an illusion?
Well, you know, there's a kind of paradox waiting for somebody who says that consciousness is an illusion, because typically what illusions are, as it were, conscious states that mislead you as to what it is that you're being presented with. So the normal assumption would be that if consciousness were an illusion, you've got a conscious state that's misleading you as to the nature of the thing you're experiencing. But that seems to saddle us with a conscious state. Now, maybe there's a way out of that. But on the face of it, A, it seems hard to understand. B, it seems quite clearly wrong in the sense that I can specify the things that I mean to be talking about. I can zero in on them and explain them well enough, I think, certainly to myself and perhaps even to you. So you're absolutely right that I'm not in the eliminativist camp. The eliminativism that I wrote about was actually about representational states rather than states of consciousness. But I'm equally against that as well. I mean, I think it's just, as it were, a Moorean fact that we have states of consciousness and that we have states of representation. As to the unified self, well, you know, that's a very complicated subject. One would have to specify in much greater detail exactly what is meant by that. There is a lot of interest in whether there is such a thing as a subject of experience, and whether the subject of experience is, as it were, conscious of itself as a subject of experience. I think all of these things have a strong phenomenological grip on us, and maybe even presupposed by the locutions that we're using in order to talk about states of consciousness. But, you know, to go further and say there is sort of a sense of unity and that we're aware of that unity and what that unity consists in, I think these take us way beyond merely talk about consciousness.
Sometimes consciousness as an illusion, even by the proponents in this area, isn't well articulated. So Thomas Metzinger was saying the same thing to me, and it, obviously you run into a paradox both logically and also intuitively. So this first person subjective experience that we're both having right now, I assume that you're having it as well, just by inference, without getting into the zombie argument, but we both assume that we're both having this first person qualitative experience. That clearly phenomenologically isn't an illusion, or else we couldn't actually be having it, A, and B, talking about it. Yes, well, most people will grant you that. What really thinkers in this area are trying to say is that this notion of first person selfhood, this notion of first person subjectivity, isn't exactly what you think it is. It's just a product of modal brain states. Someone as like Michael Graziano at Princeton goes as far as to say that it's basically brain's way of dealing with data, both externally and then how it's processed internally. And then you get this model of a self and subjective experience. Now, that doesn't do away with the phenomenological experience of quality on the one hand, but it also goes to at least try to explain why this first person experience of I and what it's like to be something isn't exactly what you think it is. For example, obviously when you take lots of alcohol, lots of coffee, you're either quite inebriated or quite awake. When you've had brain damage to certain aspects of the brain, you no longer have a certain perceptual experience of the world. Is this something you're at least willing to accept, or do you also have challenges for this?
Well, how could it be denied? It's obvious that taking in a substance like alcohol can have an impact on the course of your mental life. So, and that, of course, requires explanation. There is a kind of dependence of the mind on the brain. But whether that's completely consistent with saying that physicalism is true is, I think, the thing that's controversial.
That's quite interesting. So I'll leave the John Hale aspects of taxonomy and definitions of how you can look at stuff in the physical and mental dichotomy, how can you apply it both ways. I'll leave that to the side for a second. But going back to physicalism, are you proposing some sort of dualism in general, property or substance dualism? Do you not think that consciousness and the mind can solely be explained by the brain?
Well, certainly not substance dualism. I think substance dualism would be very hard to reconcile the known facts about neural dependence. So property dualism, but property dualism, that's just a name for the problem, because there's a question of how these mental properties are related to the physical properties or to the underlying brain properties, so that we can explain how the one emerges from the other. And what we lack right now is any conception of how mental properties could emerge on the basis of purely physical properties. And that's why, distinguished thinkers like Nagel and Chalmers basically, flirt with the idea of panpsychism.
So, that was going to be, okay.
Even the most basic constituents of the universe are already in some sense proto-conscious, because otherwise there'll be no explaining how consciousness ever emerges, from just these various billiard balls, as it were, hitting one another. Now, panpsychism is becoming to be taken very seriously in contemporary philosophy, although, it strikes most people as quite bizarre. The idea that maybe even electrons might be conscious in some sense. So the obvious way of dealing with that is to say, well, maybe not. They're not fully conscious, they're proto-conscious. But then, of course, you face this problem of saying, the so-called combination problem of saying, well, what is it about certain complexes of proto-conscious things that lead them to be fully conscious? Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of version of the emergence problem that arises all over again.
With a stepping stone problem from, that's a good way to put it. Just to back up on two things there. So firstly, you're willing to say that some kind of conscious phenomenon may not be solely reducible or explainable by the physical brain, but you're at this stage just willing to state that there is an epistemological gap, like Joseph Levine would say, an epistemological gap from physical straight to the mental. You're not fully going into the camp of panpsychism. Do you know who Philip Goff is, incidentally?
I do, yes.
Okay, so I did Philip Goff about 2 years ago, and Stuart Hameroff as well, who are kind of in this camp. Philip Goff's book, I believe, is out this year, so it'll be a good read. But yes, it's come back on the agenda quite considerably. But at this stage, is it okay to say that you think there's an epistemological gap, and therefore an explanatory gap?
There's certainly an explanatory gap between physical properties as standardly conceived and mental properties. There's no question about that. And in my case, I have actually focused more on the problem of representation than on the problem of consciousness, and arguing that, in fact, although people typically think that consciousness is the really hard issue, and that representation might be much more tractable in physicalist terms, that there is nearly as much of an issue about representation as there is about consciousness.
Talk about your work in representation and how it relates to this area.
Well, it connects up to Wittgenstein, who was very interested in this, and the so-called rule-following problem, which is really a version of the kind of issue I'm talking about. Basically, the thing is that, a lot of the representations that we have are in some sense infinitary in nature. That is, they have infinitary extensions. Or take the thing that Kripke made famous by way of explicating Wittgenstein. We believe that we have a grasp of the addition function. But the addition function, of course, is the function that it is in virtue of the fact that it is one set of infinite triples as opposed to another. So 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, and so forth, where the third entry gives you the sum of the first two. So the question is, well, how is it possible for this kind of infinitary object to be represented in a finite mind such as ours, or even in a finite machine such as a calculator? Because finite minds like ours will eventually break down. That is, there are numbers beyond which they can't compute, or there are numbers beyond which they can't grasp, or there are numbers beyond which they would die before somebody even completed the question. So the question is, what are the materials out of which you could reconstruct their grasp of these kinds of infinitary objects, even though it's quite clear that we grasp them? And so this is something I think that Wittgenstein was the first to really understand the significance of, And it gets a very powerful explanation in Kripke's book on Wittgenstein, the book called Wittgenstein on Rules in Private Language. As I say, I think when Chalmers first came up with the label, the hard problem, to focus on the case of consciousness and phenomenology, you know, he was contrasting it explicitly. He said, I think he said something like, you know, states like belief and attitude, propositional attitudes in general are, they're puzzles, but they're not mysteries. But consciousness is a real mystery. And I guess I'm inclined to think that there's sort of more of a mystery about representation than people assume, that they are both very, very difficult to grapple with.
Talking about representation and realism and anti-realism to a certain extent, you sound like more of a realist, but there might be some type of anti-realist tendencies, depending how you define it. But which one are you, and if so, how does this potentially help in the study of representation and consciousness itself? I mean, if you are a realist, what kind, generally, would you label yourself as, semantic realist? Or is this even an area that you consider when bringing insight into the area of consciousness?
You know, realism is a technical term. One has to say what one means by it.
For brevity, I will go with the Hilary Putnam one, which is, you know, something that's external to the human mind.
Well, I mean, minds are not external to human minds, but so that won't do as a general definition, because I want to be a realist about minds, as it were, but that's not because they're external to the mind itself. See what I mean? But I think, intuitively, we mean by realism that something exists and more or less has the nature that we take it to have. And so, absolutely, I mean, I tend in general to be realist about virtually everything, including the thing that's most difficult to be realist about, which is normativity, which is something that we haven't even broached here, which is neither consciousness nor representation, but namely the idea that there are facts about what one ought to do and what one ought to believe. I think one of the things that one ought to say is that philosophers basically divide into those who think that they basically understand what's going on and those who think that the world is a very mysterious place. And I am one of those who thinks it's a very mysterious place. So I think there are a lot of mysteries. Consciousness is one, representation is another, normativity is a third, abstraction is a fourth. And I am not about to rush into detailed views about these things, because I think that they are so delicate and yet so important that, you know, the best we can do is approach them very carefully and very slowly and try to make as much sense of them as we can. But I am not at all averse, you see, as a general matter, to thinking that there are fundamental truths, not further reducible, about consciousness, about representation, normativity, about abstraction, about modality, and so on. These are all things that we know to be real and which we cannot reduce to, so for instance, some simple physical basis.
So I appreciate what you're saying about realism. So take another way of explaining that approach would be something that exists when no one isn't looking out. Of course, that applies to one's own mind and someone else's mind. If you took it like scientific realism, something that exists whether the mind observes it or not, if you look at the classic dichotomy between realism and idealism, if you were going to try to separate the two. Now, if you're going to give this broader definition, which opens the doors to ambiguity, but for the reasons that you've stated why that's necessary, because of this overarching mystery in any kind of ontological existence, that's fair enough. But then if you're asserting that realism is simply something that's real in itself that you assume exists, then that starts to cause problems in terms of aspects of free will and unconscious processing. So you might think that you have free will, and therefore under some of your definitions you might think that's real, but then again there's lots of ways to think about that from at least scientific realism to show that why that might not actually be real.
Do you mean to say that there are things that you might be committed to as real which science would disavow?
Essentially, yes, under scientific realism, yeah. If you take realism to be that something that you think is real and it at least exists in some respects or has some characteristics.
It's an interesting question you raise. I mean, you know, free will is one of the most difficult, in part because there we're really not clear exactly what it is that we mean by it and what it is that we're willing to settle for. So, you know, if by free will you mean the kind of thing that is compatible with the with a strict deterministic view, then, you know, you could see how science might come in and say there are various phenomena where you thought you were exercising free will in that sense, but you weren't. But in general, there'd be no problem in reconciling science with free will in that compatibilist sense. On the other hand, if you meant something much more ambitious and dubious, or anyway, of unclear exactly how coherent it is, that is some kind of notion of a subject intervening in the causal nexus in some way that is not itself causally explained, then, you know, that is a very problematic notion, though it's admittedly the one that people seem to be hankering after when they say that they want real freedom of will rather than just some compatibilist substitute. You know, while you could very well imagine that there are these experiments which seem to show that certain motor neurons were active before the subject could report that they had made a decision about what they were going to do. It's as though, you know, you can see that the brain has already taken a decision about which action to perform before the subject seems to be aware of what of what the decision was. And so that would be a kind of interesting case in which it looks as though science is correcting for the subjective sense that it is the person is making a decision and then acting on that decision. So that, I am open to the possibility that there are illusions of that sort and that science can actually step in and correct some of the things that we introspectively think are true. What I can't imagine is that science would correct our impression that we experience states of consciousness or phenomenal states. And I don't imagine that it could come in and correct our subjective impression that we have thoughts and that we reason with them.
As you were saying there, what you said previously, to a certain extent, you can argue or at least imagine there's aspects of one's internal mental and conscious phenomena that can be, to a certain extent, an illusion. But firstly, that depends on how we're defining these illusions. And then secondly, the actual scope and breadth of all these illusions.
That's very nicely put, yeah.
And it's obviously hard to see how they would account for all of these mental and conscious phenomena. What are your current research areas, as in, have you got any forthcoming papers, any presentations, lecture series or books?
Yeah, I'm working on too many things as usual. One thing I'm doing is finishing a series of, a book that's a series of exchanges with Timothy Williamson, who you probably know as philosopher in Oxford. And he and I have over the years had a bunch of exchanges about the a priori and the analytic. And so one of the things that we decided to do a book that collects some of these exchanges and incorporate some new ones. So I'm working on that. I'm working on the nature of normativity and how we can be normative realists, which is an extremely difficult and interesting topic. I'm also working on aesthetic value, which unfortunately is the one thing that I think one cannot be a realist about, even though that took me a bit by surprise that my arguments seemed to lead to an anti-realist conclusion. And one of the very big projects that I'm working on these days is about the nature of inference, what it is to reason from one proposition to another, and how to distinguish that from, as it were, a mere association of thought.
Are you taking an interdisciplinary approach to that in terms of looking at aspects of psychology, neuroscience and philosophy of mind, or is it more from a strict, drier analytic philosophy position?
We're trying not to make it too dry, but no, definitely, you know, there's obviously very interesting psychological work. But a lot of the, this will be a seminar I'll be giving in the spring with Crispin Wright, who is another UK philosopher. And our approach will be largely philosophical, though we'll be taking into account, you know, psychological literature as it pertains to it.
It seems obviously because you specialise in a few topics, I could probably ask you stuff that's not even related to consciousness, but then somehow is related to consciousness.
Well, there's a lot, you know, because one of the interesting questions is about the role of consciousness in epistemology, in knowledge. And that's a very fertile and difficult area. I mean, I think, again, this runs against the grain of the way people think these days, because they tend to think in these very externalist and reliabilist terms. as though all that matters for the justification that you have for a belief is whether it was produced by a reliable mechanism, whether or not you know about that mechanism or its reliability. But that seems to a lot of us more old-fashioned internalists to be a change of subject. And what that implies is that basing your beliefs on conscious states of which you are aware is an essential part of the story about what makes you justified in holding those beliefs. So there's a whole other aspect to consciousness which one could explore, namely its role in the theory of rationality and the theory of knowledge.
There's certain problems obviously going to be with any kind of scientific definition, especially as you're saying, in terms of how one obviously defines something and then how one infers it without looking at the actual mechanisms that cause it. But to a certain extent, that's obviously why scientists kind of do the quick shortcut and just operationalize definitions, and that gets carried A, B equals C. But obviously, as you're saying, that's got problems in terms of not looking at the underlying background assumptions of the mechanics that come with those definitions. I'm assuming at this stage you're probably not the biggest fan of someone like Richard Dawkins.
I don't know which aspect of his thought you think I would object to.
As an atheist myself, I have a lot of respect for Richard Dawkins in general, but I do sometimes think that perhaps someone, obviously he's a professor himself in evolutionary biology, but someone could give him the 101 course in philosophy of science. It probably wouldn't hurt him that much. Just a little bit, but do you know who Donald Hoffman is at all?
Donald Hoffman, no, doesn't.
He's at UC Irvine, and he's got a book coming out beginning of 2018 on Norton Press, and bits of it sound similar to your position, but bits of it would be quite distinct. But he's coining a phrase called conscious realism, in terms of, it's not fully panpsychic, but the fundamental ontological existence of anything is the mental, and from that comes everything, including space-time.
It's idealism.
That's what I was speaking to him about. I was involved in editing his book as well, and obviously how is that not an idealist position? But he's trying to rephrase it in it's idealist in terms of the primacy of the mental, yet consciousness is itself something that's real, therefore conscious realism itself creates everything. So it's not as in there's like a filter coming back in through idealism. It's like consciousness literally is the reality, and then it pushes it out, it inverts it. So it's something more similar to panpsychism, because it sounds idealist on the one hand, yet on the other it's conscious realism. So how is it that we can have time space bending under something like Einstein? It's because it's realism but caused by consciousness. Already from your response I can see how bits of it you would like and bits you wouldn't agree with.
I'm not an idealist. Idealism doesn't necessarily refer to the generation of things by ideas. It's more of the view that the mental is fundamental. And things emerge from the mental. It's a kind of inversion of physicalism. So, and you know, this was a very common view in the 19th century. It's part of the reason why analytic philosophy kind of tends to regard everybody